Welcome to the Spotlight Edition of the Future of Medicine podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Craig Wright. Join me as I have conversations with some of my favorite medical experts discussing a variety of common health questions. I hope you find this useful, empowering you with confidence along your journey toward optimal health. Let's jump right in. Dr. James Gentry graduated from the University of Arkansas before completing his medical education at the University of Missouri, Kansas City School of Medicine, where he graduated summa cum laude. He served his internal medicine residency at Duke University Hospital and then his cardiology fellowship at the Cleveland Clinic. There, he also completed advanced fellowship training in cardiac imaging and is level 3 trained in cardiac MRI, echocardiography, nuclear cardiology, and cardiac CT. Following his training, he joined Centennial Heart in 2019 and practices at their Nashville and Brentwood offices. Dr. Gentry has special interest in valvular heart disease, aortopathies, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and sports cardiology. He enjoys educating patients about their cardiovascular disease to empower them to be more involved in their individual treatment plans. Join us today as we discuss how to understand one's risk, advancements in diagnostics, as well as medication management and much more. Well, Jim, thanks again for taking the time to be with me today. Really looking forward to this conversation because we've got a lot of ground to cover. A lot of great stuff that I know we'll get into. So thanks for your time.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Absolutely. Let's actually introduce you kind of to our listeners just by telling me a little bit about what inspired you to go down the path of cardiology.
Sure. Yeah. So I grew up, my dad was a family practice physician, so kind of grew up around primary care. That's kind of what I knew. A lot of heart disease ran in my family. And so as part of that, as I kind of got into med school, it was always the heart was a little bit more easier to learn. The physiology, the logistics, all of that made more sense to me. And as I kind of pursued further into my medical training, once again, that cardiologist always just came back to home and then made it easier to learn. And that's where we're at. I think when I first started cardiology training, I think back to seeing echoes, which is an ultrasound of the heart, seeing the heart moving, the valves moving. And that was always what I associated with the heart, actually seeing the heart moving. Mm-hmm. And so as the training continued to progress, I did a couple extra years in advanced cardiac imaging training with echoes, cardiac CTs, and cardiac MRI, just to further specialize in that area.
Yeah. I didn't realize your dad was a primary care doc.
Yes,
so,
he was.
So yeah, you were raised in the environment that probably talks about a lot of the things that I get to talk about on
exactly.
a daily basis.
Yes.
And our goal is usually to keep people away from having to see you.
Yes.
If we can.
Yes.
And just save you for the things that, you know, the things that maybe that can't be directly prevented and things like that. We do a lot of preventive medicine in our practice. So we'll actually get into those topics. And that's actually the first place I want to start is, you know, if somebody's only going to listen to the next couple of minutes of this podcast, you know, in general, what is one or two things that you feel like people can do to better protect their cardiovascular health?
So great question there. I think it's important to make sure to start at an early age or mm-hmm. as early as you can. Once again, the earlier you start that preventative treatment or therapy, the better. I think we don't realize that heart disease starts in our adolescence.
Yeah.
You start getting the plaque that develops with fatty streaks in your blood vessels, and that progresses to atherosclerotic plaque later in life. So at a young age or whatever age patients may be, it's important to kind of be proactive at this point and do things like exercise regularly, obviously avoid smoking, try and eat healthy. I mean, it's the stuff that makes common sense, but the earlier you can start following those guidelines, I think the better.
Yeah. I love that you said that because I think really something that's changed in me in the last 10 years is how aggressive I get with younger people.
Mm-hmm.
That yes, the end stages of disease, especially with cardiovascular disease, are often going to be later in life, but the groundwork is being laid early. And it's really never too early to look at someone's blood pressure or look at somebody's weight and metabolic health in the setting of what that sets them up for in the future with their heart.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. I'm always amazed. I'll see some young people with palpitations here and there in their 20s or 30s. And I was like, have you had your cholesterol levels checked? And they're like, no one's ever checked that. But like, those are important things to find out when you're in your 20s, if your cholesterol is off, rather than finding out when you've got an event in your 40s or 50s. Mm-hmm. Now we're trying to backtrack from there.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a progressive disease, you know, and I don't know if you would agree with this, but I often tell patients, you know, it's something we're either going to die from or with,
You know, it's the arthritis of the blood vessels, you know, and we just want to make sure that it is slowly progressive, that it is minimal when we're young, minimal when we're old, so that they've lived a full, happy life. Now, that's a great, I love that you brought that up. And kind of along those lines, the next place I'd love to go is really talking about how best to assess someone's risk of developing cardiovascular disease. Yeah. So you mentioned a few of those lifestyle habits that obviously want to be talked about and avoided, many of them. And traditionally, you know, you look at cholesterol and blood pressure, maybe an A1C level to look at metabolic health, and all those are super useful. Is there any way to take it to the next level? And to, is there any testing that can be done that kind of guides the individual more into how likely they could be to develop advancing disease?
Yeah, no, fortunately, there's lots of different options that we have now available that we didn't used to. One thing I did want to highlight before we get into that is obviously we worry about diabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia. I think other diseases and things that we need to kind of keep track of, other risk factors are obviously, as I mentioned earlier, tobacco abuse, family history of heart disease, especially if it's premature. And I think one other area that we have to be especially careful about is patients with autoimmune conditions. Mm-hmm. They have systemic inflammation going on in their body. And so I think those patients are at especially high risk of cardiovascular disease and that I don't feel like we appreciate the severity of. Things like even psoriasis, lupus, different autoimmune conditions that develop advanced disease before we know it.
Yeah. Are there specific ones that come to mind, or is it just that general feel of the autoimmune?
I think it's just the general feel of the autoimmune conditions. Once again, just that because of the autoimmune condition ongoing, they've got systemic inflammation throughout their body. That itself, as we've learned, it's not only actually cholesterol levels that develop atherosclerotic plaque. It's a combination of both that and in an inflammatory process that drive both of those, that drive the atherosclerotic disease.
Yeah.
And so I think we forget about the inflammatory side of things. We've always treated high cholesterol with statins, which fortunately drop your cholesterol levels, but also have an anti-inflammatory property to them. So we've actually been treating both sides of things. It's not until we've developed other anti-lipid therapies that aren't anti-inflammatory that we've noticed that there's a difference from that perspective.
Interesting. Yeah. I love that. I wouldn't have immediately thought that, but it makes sense. You know, the chronic inflammation that can occur is such a part of the plaque formation, either at its origin or at its process. So,
But yeah, to get back to your original question, other sort of tools that we have out there, obviously the groundwork is our just basic lipid panel. That's not anything new. But beyond there, I think we fortunately have new lab tests like apolipoprotein B, lipoprotein A are two different lipoproteins that we can check on patients that help guide us in terms of understanding patients' cardiovascular risk. You can check particle size, high sensitivity CRP, but I think those have fallen a little bit out of favor as the other tests that I just mentioned seem to be a little bit more predictive. That's, I guess, from a laboratory standpoint. Obviously, we've got coronary CTA and coronary artery calcium scores. That can also help understand patients' risk if they're borderline or if they've got a strong family history and want to make sure that they're not at higher risk than their risk profile would already predict.
Great. Now, with that LP little a that you're mentioning, to my understanding, that is more hereditary. It's more uninfluenced by one's weight or exercise or diet. So is that fair
is
to say?
Yeah, actually about one in five patients actually have an elevated lipoprotein A, which is kind of scary. It is kind of a pro atherosclerotic lipoprotein that will deposit in your blood vessels, cause the atherosclerotic process to accelerate. And then actually, interestingly, also will cause narrowing of your aortic valve at a younger age than what would otherwise predict. So it not only is affecting your blood vessels, but other areas of your heart. Actually had a patient that developed severe narrowing of his aortic valve recently, whose lipoprotein A was very, very high. And that's likely the reason why.
Wow. And at this point, no real interventions can be done for the LP little a directly. I understand there's some things in the works, but nothing really available.
Good question. So statins don't lower lipoprotein A, unfortunately. And as you said earlier, it is a genetic predisposition. Mm-hmm. And once again, the nice thing with the lipoprotein A is it actually only needs to be checked once in your lifetime compared to other sort of lipid panels. Interestingly, PCSK9 inhibitors, which are one of our new therapies that we can use to get people's lipid levels down, actually does drop your lipoprotein A actually by about 30% or so.
Oh, okay.
Right now, there's ongoing trials looking at patients that have elevated lipoprotein A's and seeing does that decrease cardiovascular events, heart attack, strokes, death. Right now, we don't have that data. We know it drops that, but we don't know does it affect long-term outcomes. Mm-hmm. So I think that'll be some interesting information that'll come out hopefully in the near future.
Yeah.
Because certainly if we're going to put somebody on a therapy, we want to make sure it's actually going to affect their, how long they're going to live. Are they going to have events rather than just basing it only on a lipoprotein A level mm-hmm. being dropped.
Tell me a little bit about the apolipoprotein B, that ApoB you mentioned.
So that is, I would say, something that I would consider very similar to kind of an LDL level. So LDL is your bad cholesterol. It follows the LDL level pretty well. It's just another way to be able to test the LDL. Are you appropriately treating that, suppressing that where it needs to be? Some people feel it's a little bit more accurate than an LDL level. So it just gives you some, one other way to kind of make sure that either determine if a patient's at higher risk and needs to be treated more aggressively, or if they're being treated, are they being treated appropriately? And is that level being suppressed is where it needs to be, similar to where we shoot for a low LDL goal of say less than 55 for someone that has had prior bypass or stent.
Gotcha. Now let's transition to an area you already touched on and I know you're passionate about when it comes to cardiac imaging.
Yeah.
So you're highly trained in cardiac imaging. Let's start by talking a little bit about maybe the what our listeners may be familiar with, like kind of a traditional calcium score and how that's obtained and the value of that, but then also the advancing images like the coronary CTA that you mentioned and anything else you'd like to get into that can just really help give us a glimpse of what's going on in that individual's heart.
Yeah. Now, those are some exciting tools that we have. So coronary artery calcium score is a non-contrast CT scan. So you don't need an IV. You just go to wherever they're able to have the CT scan performed. You just lay down there. They do a scan of your chest and can look and see, is there calcified plaque? I think one important thing to understand here is atherosclerosis starts off as a soft plaque. That plaque over time becomes calcified as your body tries to get rid of that. So we're actually only seeing the calcified plaque on the coronary artery calcium scores. So we do not see the soft plaque. And unfortunately, that soft plaque is the plaque that is prone to plaque rupture, blocking off the blood vessels, and is more likely to cause you to have a heart attack, actually, than your 70, 80, 90% stenosis of a calcified plaque, which is kind of counterintuitive. And so, although it gives you a prediction of what their risk is, do they have plaque? There may be hidden plaque in there. Once again, if your calcium score is zero, you have no calcified plaque, but that doesn't mean that there's no coronary plaque in there that could be soft, that could be hiding in there. I think patients that are under 40, it is not the most helpful tool. Typically, plaque's not going to be calcified that early. Can be, but certainly if it is at that point, then they're certainly a very high risk. But it's one of those tools that once they're 40, I think it's something that you can consider using. The other test, coronary CTA that you mentioned, so that's a little bit more of an advanced test. So these patients will come in, we'll give them IV beta blockers or other different medications to slow their heart rate down to about 60 beats a minute. While we're imaging, obviously we're trying to see the coronary arteries and we need to be able to see them when they're not moving. So the slower their heart rates are, the better it is to allow us time to appropriately image their hearts. And the faster your CT scan is, the more accurately you can assess the arteries. So once again, we slow their heart rates down. We'll give them nitroglycerin underneath their tongue that dilates out their blood vessels. This is the same medication patients will take if they're having angina for blockages to help kind of relieve that pain. But that'll dilate out the arteries so that we can see them better once again. And then they've got an IV. And through that IV, they inject contrast and put them through the scanner. And that scanner, once again, can now allow us to get a non-invasive or virtual evaluation of their coronary arteries, very similar to a heart catheterization that you would get before a stent or bypass surgery.
That's amazing, you know, and I don't know how far you feel like that technology has come, but you know, the fact that the conversation around cardiovascular health now is where you can get so much information without being invasive.
Yes.
Is amazing.
Yeah.
And as you know, we've talked before that our practice, we try to stay aggressively proactive. We definitely want to identify things that somebody may be at risk for well before they're symptomatic, or definitely before any chronic end-stage disease has developed. And coronary CTA has been a great tool we've used. And I think there's so many, there's so much value you can get from that soft plaque.
Mm-hmm.
Because for so long in my career in primary care, I would order calcium scores and you'd get, you know, zeros or single low digit levels. And that was very reassuring, but my eyes were not open to what we were missing. Mm-hmm. And someone may have a fairly high soft plaque burden that has yet to calcify. And to my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, that the soft plaque is what ruptures. It's what can cause those acute events like heart attacks.
Yep.
And that stabilized calcified plaque is not going to rupture.
Yeah, that's going to be your safer plaque.
Yeah.
Can be less likely to progress. And interestingly, when we treat patients with statins, it actually makes that soft plaque become calcified. So we actually want it to become calcified because we know it's safer. So some people, if you get a calcium score of, let's say 5 years after your original one, it's going to be much higher. And you want it to be higher because you want that soft plaque that was there that you probably didn't see or that you didn't see. You want that to be calcified plaque now.
Yeah. And statins actually kind of accelerate that process.
Correct.
To calcify.
They transition it to that calcified safer plaque.
Okay.
One thing I would also highlight, you mentioned you felt kind of reassured if you've got someone with a calcium score in the single digits. It's interesting, if you actually even look at patients who are in the single digits versus a calcium score of zero, their risk is actually significantly higher, just having a calcium score of one.
Wow.
So I will oftentimes be aggressive and treat those as well because there is plaque there. It once again had to start soft and is now calcified versus someone that's got a score of zero.
Yeah.
If you look at their mortality curves over time, there's actually a significant difference even between zero and one.
Wow. I would not have thought there had been that significant a difference for sure. Well, and I'll say for how I practice now with the advancements in coronary CTA and even getting some extra reads from like a Clearly Diagnostics or a company that has developed technology to better quantify and qualify the type of plaque you have, I don't really order calcium scores anymore.
Yeah.
It's kind of fallen off the wayside. Too much information is lost. So I'm glad to hear kind of echo your thoughts there. And I know you're well trained in imaging. So I want to see what kind of other images are important to someone's cardiovascular health. And obviously this gets a little more specific maybe to the patient's need and history, but just tell me a little bit about the role for maybe stress echocardiograms or stress MRIs or some of the other tests that I see come back to me when I refer out to a cardiologist. What's the role for those tests in the population?
Yeah, so I think it's important to kind of keep, I guess, the patient in mind of why they're coming in, what their symptoms are. I would say those sort of tests are probably going to be more reserved for someone with symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Stress echo, I tend to use that probably in our younger population, ones that I don't want to expose to radiation. Also, the nice thing with like stress echo is, let's say someone's having symptoms while they're exercising, you can recreate the exercise environment. If their symptoms are reproduced, but the heart looks good on the stress echo, I think you can feel reassured if everything looks good on the test that, hey, I've recreated these symptoms and everything checked out normal, given that sort of reassurance. Stress MRI is done with a pharmacological agent called regadenoson that'll dilate out their blood vessels. So not, it's trying to simulate exercise, but they're not truly exercising. So that might be, once again, maybe someone that is not able to exercise well. I would say that might be a good test in someone that has a larger BMI. A lot of our other sort of tests, CT, the image quality drops off as their weight goes up. Echocardiography can be hard just because we're imaging through the ribs And if there's more tissue to try and image through, we don't see as well. So stress MRI actually has excellent images in our larger patients. So that might be a good tool to use in some of our larger patients or even younger patients, once again, because there's not radiation exposure with cardiac MRI as there is with CT.
Okay. Any other images you'd like to highlight?
Yeah, I think not necessarily so much cardiac that we think of, but I think tools that you guys might order that I think are important to kind of think about that also give you cardiovascular information is actually like a lung cancer screening CT. I'm still actually surprised to this day that they don't actually do a calcium score with it because it's the same CT.
Really?
It's
okay.
Just it's in of the whole chest rather than just of the heart area, but obviously the heart's included in the chest. I will go back and measure them on these CTs myself if I've got a patient that had one and calculate it myself. So that's important information to kind of think about. Hey, I'm screening someone for lung cancer. They've smoked before. Once again, a very high risk factor of heart disease. There's a good chance that they could have coronary artery disease. So I think that's another tool to think about. The other one that's kind of advancing is actually mammograms. Breast arterial calcification can be picked up on the mammograms. And that has been associated with cardiovascular disease. It's correlating with coronary artery disease as well. Obviously, I don't read a lot of mammograms. I don't see the reports of a lot of them. And so I don't know if they comment on breast arterial calcification or not. But that's also kind of evolving in the literature as well as a couple other tools that we don't necessarily always think about.
Yeah. You know, I find sometimes, and this, you know, kind of echoes that point, when I may be imaging another area of the body and it becomes a peripheral finding that there's some atherosclerosis or something that's commented on in an area that I'm like, oh, I wasn't really expecting that. Or, hey, let's look into that a little further. And so
and
it sounds like
seeing plaque in an artery not related to the heart, if it's there, it can be other places.
Yeah.
Obviously, we've talked a lot about coronary artery disease, but if they've got plaque there, there's a good chance they could have it in their carotid arteries.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, that increases their risk of strokes. And I think we probably don't, I know I don't think about risk of strokes as much as I should be. And I think patients are oftentimes more concerned about the risk of a stroke than a heart attack because it can be obviously very debilitating.
Yeah. No.
I guess that'd be another tool. I mean, you obviously could do a carotid ultrasound to kind of assess for plaque burden.
Great. All right. So the next place I want to go is really talking about how to kind of limit the risk that someone may have. So whether it's something that we determine through their lab work or through images that they are at risk, how can we help them manage their risk factor? And so let's start by talking about a little bit about nutrition. And I know it's kind of, from my understanding, the discussion around how to nutritionally manage cholesterol specifically, the response depends on who you reach out to.
Yes.
So I want to ask you, kind of tell me about the nutritional management of someone who maybe has high cholesterol levels.
Yeah, so I think one, I guess, probably depends on, are we talking about LDL or triglycerides? I'll kind of hit on triglycerides first because that's just a little bit easier. So if triglycerides are high, obviously you need to try and limit their carbs, need to limit their alcohol intake. This isn't a diet, but obviously exercise can also help reduce those triglyceride levels and getting their diabetes under control, what I kind of think about there. From an LDL perspective, I guess what we know the most about is trying to kind of follow more of like a Mediterranean sort of diet. Obviously eat more white meats, so chicken, fish, less sort of red meats. Fruits and vegetables are great. Cook with olive oil is a good trick to use instead of vegetable oil. Avocados, nuts are a good sort of snack to try and think. Obviously, you got to watch hypertension if they're nuts, if there's a lot of salt on the nuts there. But I think that's kind of what I think about. And I guess the other thing I will mention to my patients too is try and avoid processed foods. There's a lot of extra stuff in there that we didn't used to eat when we were all hunters and gatherers. And so I think those are kind of the tools that I talk about when I see patients to talk about from a preventative diet perspective.
Any role for dietary cholesterol in terms of someone's blood level of cholesterol?
Are you talking about like the total cholesterol level?
Yeah. Like when I'm giving, I may be talking to, about giving them guidance with their cholesterol levels. They always ask, well, like how much cholesterol should I eat in my diet? You know, it's something on those nutrition facts that they can read. To my understanding, there's not much usefulness there. Limiting someone's dietary cholesterol has no effect on blood cholesterol.
Correct. I haven't been able to be too successful there in terms of and trying to figure out how much of that actually gets absorbed is also very, very variable from one patient to the next. So not as predictive.
Yeah. So to hear you, and correct me if I'm not summarizing well, but triglycerides, there's a lot of influence through diet, a lot of influence through exercise, alcohol. With LDL cholesterol, maybe less dietary influence, still something you need to be mindful of and do your best for.
Yeah.
But oftentimes the gains you can get in that might be a little less.
Correct. Yeah. Gotcha. That's a good way to put that.
Well, that's what I see practically. You know, some of my patients who might have quite high levels, they really want to, and I encourage, you know, lifestyle management, and they'll give that a try with maybe some dietary changes, and they really just don't gain much. And it's always disheartening because, this person has tried so hard. And
there's a couple people that'll get it. You're very impressed on how they can change it. But in general, it only will change it maybe 10-ish percent, 10-20 percent. I wish you could get more benefit there.
Yeah. Which that kind of leads us to, okay, well, what then? Yeah. What next? And you know, I'll definitely ask if there's any, supplements or things that you might see or read about that could have some usefulness. But obviously, there's a lot of knowledge and data around the pharmaceutical meds, their risk and benefits. So I'll let you take it from there with what you might suggest after lifestyle management has not gained it needs to.
Yeah. So if we can't get their cholesterol levels to their goals, I mean, I think our first go-to is statins. They've been around for 30 plus years now. We've got, as you said, lots of data on them, risk, benefits. And in general, they're a very safe medication. As I mentioned earlier too, they're not only lowering your cholesterol levels, but they also have anti-inflammatory properties that both help prevent that progression of plaque from two different perspectives. In general, they're very well tolerated. Maybe 10% of patients will get muscle aches. Those that do get muscle aches, I'll usually switch to a different statin. So if I started with Lipitor first, I'll switch them to rosuvastatin, which is metabolized differently through their liver and less likely to cause muscle aches. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can then grab like pravastatin if you need another one. That one also is pretty well tolerated if someone's had a statin allergy or statin intolerance. Mm-hmm. You can add coenzyme Q10 to help them tolerate that better at times might help. If someone is really not interested in statin therapy, a little bit more kind of a natural path, I think using red yeast rice at least offers a little bit of benefit. Mm-hmm. It's actually a very weak statin. This is kind of where statins originated from, but it's natural.
Okay.
And that can be at least something that you can offer some patients if they're truly not interested in a pharmacological approach. So that's kind of my thoughts on statins. If they don't tolerate two different statins, or if we can't get their cholesterol levels to goal despite a maximum tolerated statin dose, I think that's when we start reaching for some of our other medications. Mm-hmm. And that includes things like ezetimibe, our PCSK9 inhibitors. And there's also bepanoic acid that's an option as well. And there continues to be more and more options coming down the pipeline. I feel like every year as conferences come out with new information.
Yeah.
The PCSK9 inhibitors have been revolutionary. Was originally created for treating patients with what we call homozygous hyperlipidemia, where their cholesterol levels, their LDLs were very high, more than 190 or 220 or even higher than that. And they're very, very effective at dropping those cholesterol levels down and helping those patients avoid further atherosclerotic disease. We've now also been reaching for those, once again, in patients that we can't get their LDLs to goal levels. Mm-hmm. And they'll drive their LDLs down to single digits, which is actually fascinating.
Yeah.
And despite that, they actually tolerate it very well. The risk, or I guess adverse events, are extremely low. I know there was initially some concern about increased risk of dementia when you've got LDL levels down in the single digits. But actually, when they look at trials of patients that were on some of these PCSK9 inhibitors, they actually had a lower risk of dementia. Once again, we're also preventing vascular dementia.
Yeah.
And obviously helps just get those levels where they need to be.
Yeah.
I think one other thing, as we're talking about LDL levels, it's important to highlight too, is we talk about LDL levels of, say, 100 being normal. I think if you look at actually children as they're developing, their levels are around 30 to 50.
Mm.
And it's when they start eating more kind of processed foods and other things change in their diet that we start actually seeing the higher cholesterol levels. So you actually have kids or babies that are developing with low LDL levels that are neurologically doing obviously very well with those low levels. So I think that gives us a lot of reassurance that even suppressing those LDL levels that low, that it's safe to do that.
That's a great, great point. Now, along those lines, because my experience with the PCSK9 inhibitors is the same. You'll start somebody and 3 months later, their LDL has fallen to the basement. Much more yes. impact than you could get maybe through a statin for sure. It is fascinating. And, you know, if I'm looking at someone who has not had known diagnosed disease and we're just managing their risk factors, you mentioned kind of considering an LDL of 100 being normal. Somebody who I may be working with that really wants to do everything they can to limit the coronary disease development process, should I consider statin and maybe other agents to get their LDL to 100 or below without an event? Or what's your thought around kind of more preventive, proactive cholesterol management?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I think obviously keeping their family history is another risk factor we have to keep in mind there if they haven't mm-hmm. had events. I think I would probably start with statins first in patients and once again, just get them on the maximum tolerated dose.
Mm-hmm.
I think shooting for a goal less than 100 in someone without established disease is a good target. I think the other thing we just need to keep in mind is what is their baseline LDL?
Mm-hmm.
Certainly if it was high, say more than 190, for sure would want that person less than 100.
Mm-hmm.
And that may actually require a statin and a PCSK9 inhibitor to get them there potentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, question.
Absolutely. No, because, you know, truly, if I just consider kind of the average person I see, LDLs likely run between 115 and 160.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe apolipoprotein Bs are there between, you know, 90 and 120.
Mm-hmm.
So suboptimal, similar. I guess you could say. But it's hard to know when to intervene pharmaceutically for those individuals.
Yeah. And I think that's where some of these other tools help you risk stratify them further.
Yeah.
Whether that's the coronary CTA, whether that's your lipoprotein A, whether that's carotid ultrasound, coronary calcium score. I think just gives you some objective evidence to know how aggressively to treat these patients.
Yeah.
And even let's say that those are normal. Certainly that's normal when that's performed, but would have a low threshold to say, hey, we're going to repeat that again in say 5 years.
Yeah.
To monitor, is it now been disease progression and now we need to be more aggressive instead of an LDL goal of less than 100. Now we need to be less than 70 mm-hmm. at that point.
Gotcha. You know, moving away a little bit on the pharmaceutical realm toward blood thinners, medicines that can kind of control the clotting pathway. So obviously we're all familiar with aspirin and its yes. role in kind of prevention of disease and really how some recommendations over the last decade have changed around that. I want to kind of see if you could speak to the role of aspirin or even some dosing for like Xarelto and how that could influence decreasing the likelihood of an event in somebody with atherosclerosis.
Yes. And so that's a very pertinent topic to talk about, especially on the aspirin side of things. Aspirin back in the day when they did trials was beneficial in reducing heart attacks and strokes.
Mm-hmm.
As we've gotten better about treating blood pressures, got better about treating cholesterol levels, the benefit of aspirin has dwindled, but the risk of aspirin, increased risk of bleeding, has not. And so in those situations, yeah. actually the overall risk benefit ratio of aspirin has declined. And I think we're probably peeling aspirin off of patients' medical list more than we ever have been before. because of that. I think, especially if somebody does not have established atherosclerotic disease, I'm taking them off of aspirin, especially as they're getting older, their risk of falling and having a major bleeding event increases. There's some data, if somebody's got a calcium score of 100 or more, that there may be some benefit of aspirin in that situation. And so those patients, I talk risk-benefit-wise, hey, as long as you're tolerating it well, your calcium score is more than 100, I would continue that. Or let's say someone's falling or someone's having a lot of bruising, bleeding, that's probably more someone I would have them come off of it, just because that benefit I don't feel like is as strong as what it should be.
Gotcha.
In terms of Xarelto, actually, let me go back 1 minute there. The other thing I think, as I'm talking about coming off of aspirin, people that have had a prior stent, prior bypass, those patients should not come off aspirin unless their cardiologist recommends that.
Good thought.
Just important point just to point out there. But getting back to say kind of like low dose Xarelto, there's some evidence in very high risk patients that say a low dose of Xarelto as a blood thinner may help prevent kind of a clot formation if there's a plaque rupture. Once again, you're weighing the risk and the benefits of a lower risk of heart attack and stroke with the risk of bleeding. So you just have to individualize that to your patient and understand what is their atherosclerotic risk. Certainly if it's high, it's high. But what is their bleeding risk too?
Now, when you're having that thought of like they're being quote high risk, is that something that you can draw directly from like their coronary CTA imaging, or do you look at other factors like the LDL cholesterol, the blood pressure? Do you look at other variables, or is it just a constellation of everything?
Honestly, it'd be a constellation of everything. Things like hypertension, hyperlipidemia, diabetes, smoking, plus objective evidence of either a prior cardiac event or atherosclerotic plaque on a coronary CTA or in their carotid ultrasound.
Gotcha. So Jim, I want to ask you kind of a practical question that I run into a lot in my primary care office. And I know there's probably 1,000 emergency departments evaluating this right now. So I have chest pain and it comes out of the blue. I don't really know what to expect. And I find that people are discharged from the hospital either with a diagnosis of reflux, anxiety or panic, or a heart attack. Tell me how I should be thinking of that, and specifically how a patient may be thinking of that when they have that chest pain symptom.
Yeah, no, that's very pertinent. I guess I'd start by saying when we think about true angina, I guess the best way to kind of describe that for patients that are listening here would be typically that's going to be a chest tightness, pressure in the chest, may radiate to the arm, usually is going to be worse with exertion, relieve with rest. Obviously, that's what we're most concerned about. But not everyone follows the textbooks. Women oftentimes have different symptoms than men. And so we can't just use that for everybody. I've been humbled numerous times with people with acid reflux. I had a gentleman that was actually having surgery to fix his acid reflux, but decided to go in the ER just because he couldn't control his acid reflux symptoms. You talk to him a little bit more, he's like, yeah, I just would get this burning sensation in my chest every time I'd run, and then it would be relieved with rest. He got a stress test and he got 2 stents the next day. I think it's important to keep in mind to listen to your symptoms. Everyone's different. I think it's important just to listen to your body. And if you're concerned about it, I think it's important to get it checked out. I think now in the world where we have coronary CTA, it actually looks, it's a CT of the whole chest. And so you can actually pick up non-cardiac findings that might be causing chest pain. There's lots of different things that can cause chest pain. And so even in those sort of patients, I mean, they oftentimes have a risk factor, either with family history or borderline cholesterol. And so they're at risk of heart disease. We're unfortunately all at risk of heart disease. And so, like I said, low threshold to get a coronary CT on them. And hey, maybe everything checks out fine. And you can say, hey, no, that was anxiety, or no, I think this is all acid reflux. But you might pick up some advanced disease. Or you may actually pick up some mild disease that you wouldn't have otherwise known about. And then now you can act on that and do further risk factor modification to help prevent that mild plaque that wasn't causing symptoms from becoming an issue down the line. I think we've talked a lot about coronary CTA today, but it's probably my preferred ischemic evaluation because of the added information we get as compared to, say, like a nuclear stress test, where you're only going to have an abnormal test if there's a 70% stenosis or narrowing of a blood vessel. If it's 50 or 40, the report's going to say it's normal because it's saying that there's not a limiting lesion there. And so I think in that situation, we can sometimes falsely reassure our patients in those situations and say, hey, everything checked out normal. I think we say them, hey, there's, you don't have a blockage, but in reality, they could have a mild blockage that we just missed.
So,
once again, just kind of highlighting, I think take your symptoms seriously and low threshold for further testing. I think especially in our anxious patients, the reassurance of knowing, hey, your coronary arteries are stone cold normal. This is equivalent of having a heart cath that your friend had. We see those blood vessels, and knowing that those are normal, I think gives them reassurance the next time those symptoms come on, that say, hey, now that's, I can stop this panic attack in the process, and that it's not going to keep perpetuating itself.
That's a great point. You know, another testament to the advances in imaging, where we can gain so much insight. And even if they get discharged with some Tums for their heartburn, they may have discovered with some image that, hey, there's actually some mild disease here that you may need to talk to your doctor about and get a plan around your weight or your cholesterol levels a little more aggressively. Well, Jim, as we kind of wrap up today, I just kind of want to end with a couple of thoughts. Is there anything, Jim, that you believed 5 years ago that you no longer believe today? And this open-ended, wherever you want to go with that.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of hit on it a little bit already, but I think aspirin, I think that's just the big thing. We used to recommend it for everybody. I even found out my mom's taking aspirin, and I was like, you don't need aspirin. But I mean, we've just learned that as we've gotten better about treating everything else, those benefits of aspirin, as we highlighted, are not as good as what they used to be. And there is risk. So I think it's important just to make sure that if we're using aspirin, that it's appropriate and not in patients that are high risk of bleeding. I think that's definitely something that has changed in the last 5 years.
Anything you're excited about on the horizon? Maybe something you have read about or knows on in the pipeline that you're excited that's coming?
I mean, I think it's the GLP-1 agonists, such as like semaglutide, are fascinating. Obviously, we've used them for weight loss, for diabetes. Interestingly, we're now actually seeing that there's cardiovascular benefits outside of the benefits of just managing their diabetes and cholesterol levels. That there's actually a 20% reduction in cardiovascular events over about like a 3-year follow-up on patients that were on these medications. And so I think from a cardiologist perspective, it's fascinating how many sort of diabetes drugs that we're now using that have shown drastic benefits in reducing cardiovascular events.
Fascinating. We'll have to have a part two to come in the future to go over all that information. So, well, Jim, thanks again for taking the time to join me today. I know this was super helpful to me and to all of our listeners. So thanks for your time.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you so much.
I want to thank you for listening to this conversation. I truly hope you found it useful. You can find out more about today's episode and discover additional content at BrentwoodMD.com/podcast. If you haven't subscribed, please do so. We would be honored if you would leave a review or even a recommendation for a future conversation you would like to hear. If you would like to learn more about the concierge services that we provide at Brentwood MD, email us at membership@brentwoodmd.com. We'd love to meet you. This podcast was for general information only and does not constitute the practice of medicine or giving of medical advice, as no doctor-patient relationship has been formed. The content of this podcast is not intended to substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Listeners should seek the advice of their own trusted medical professionals.